The Guardian.
I define creativity as the process of having original ideas that have value. Divergent thinking isn't a synonym, but it's an essential capacity for creativity. It's the ability to see lots of possible answers to a question.
It is held up as a trait that sets us apart from the rest of the animals. The ability to think so creatively, to use our powerful imaginations to shape the world around us.
To see multiple answers, not one.
But how our imagination became so crucial to our existence remains a mystery, with plenty of competing theories put forward. What ideas have scientists come up with? And with something as complex as creativity, how do we even define it, let alone study it in the lab?
Understanding creativity and cooperation is what makes us humans really distinctive, really exceptional, but it has very, very dark possibilities as well as wonderful, engaging, positive possibilities.
So all of these has now led to more questions and more puzzles about what we need to do next. But it's certainly been very, very useful, all of the advances that we've had, to get us closer to really understanding what happens in the brain when we're trying to be creative.
I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
Hello.
Hi, Anna, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I've become human again. I've heard I sound like a robot when it first starts.
In a moment, we will look back at our evolutionary past and cobble together as best we can the pieces of how creativity may have helped our ancestors to survive. But let's start in the here and now.
I have looked at it, and I think all of it sounds useful.
This is Dr. Anna Abraham.
Yeah, so I'm Anna Abraham, and I work as a reader in psychology at Leeds Beckett University. And from training here, I'm a cognitive psychologist and a neuroscientist who studies creativity and other aspects of the human imagination.
Producer Max spoke to Anna via Skype this week and started by asking her how she defines creativity.
I take the field definition of creativity, which is quite uncontroversial, really. And in that, we basically emphasize two components, which is originality and relevance at the center of the definition of creativity. An idea is creative in the extent that it is both original or unique or novel, as well as appropriate or relevant or fitting to a particular context. So any product, idea, widget, gadget, everything is defined to be creative if it is both original as well as relevant to a particular end.
How important have sort of recent advances in neuroscience been in this study of human creativity?
I think it's been as important as it has been for any aspect of psychology, really, because before the advent of neuroscientific techniques, we didn't know too much about what was happening in the brain when people were being creative. So the only pieces of information we were getting were actually very, very interesting neuropsychological cases of people who had, sometimes you have these situations where you have certain forms of dementia, a subset of patients who go through it, develop extreme sort of de novo artistic capabilities afterwards and so on. So you have sort of neuropsychological evidence that there are aspects of brain function that are very, very intimately tied with our capacity to produce creative responses. But the advent of neuroimaging and so on just allowed us to look at things in real time. So give somebody a creative task to do while their brain activity is being measured. And it allowed us to dispel certain notions. So, for instance, the idea that there's one part of the brain that is involved in creative thinking and it's distinct from other parts of the brain that are not involved in creative thinking, this is not true. It showed us that we needed to consider not just brain structures and single structures, but brain networks. It's told us a lot about how it's not possible to think about creativity without really thinking about normative aspects of cognition. So all of these has now led to more questions and more puzzles about what we need to do next. But it's certainly been very, very useful, all of the advances that we've had, to get us closer to really understanding what happens in the brain when we're trying to be creative.
So it seems that in searching for answers, we've found more questions. But as Anna mentions, recent work has highlighted the difference between what she calls normative or normal cognition and creative cognition. Are they really that different?
I would say it is the same and it is also very different. And I can qualify that by saying that what neuroscience has basically allowed us to see is that there are, if you want to take a sort of computational analogy, information processing toolboxes in the brain that do many, many different things. And whether I'm trying to retrieve a poem from memory to recite it, or whether I'm trying to write a poem, when I'm thinking about something from my past, the same brain networks that are involved in memory retrieval will be kicking into place. Whether I'm trying to use it for the service of memorizing and recalling for a test or recitation, or whether I'm trying to just sort of retrieve something that will inspire me to write a new poem. So in that sense, of course, the information processing systems are very similar. The toolbox that is used for one is going to be the same as the other, because there are a lot of parallel processes. The way that it is different is that creativity involves generating something new. So it's not about retrieving something old. So you can't, I think it was Scott Barry Kaufman who once said this, you can't Google a creative idea. It has to come from within you. So you're using the same toolboxes, but to different ends. The context is what is very different. And, you know, cognitive psychologists who study creativity, people who proposed the Gina Plour model and so on, were very aware of this from the start. What they said was that when you think about cognitive operations, whether you're using it for creative or non-creative means, that's not really the point. You're using the same operations and mechanisms. It's just that in the case of creative idea generation, the context is open-ended, unknown, and you have to discover something new. You have to generate something new from something known. So the toolboxes might be the same and are used in very similar ways as you would for normative cognition, but for creative cognition, you're applying it in a completely different situation.
There are issues then in pinning down what creativity is and what underpins it in the brain, none of which helps researchers like Anna, who work on creativity in the lab.
And something you've sort of you mentioned memory quite a lot, and obviously that plays a big role in this, but you know, similarly within neuroscience, we thought memory was one thing, and now we have, you know, I don't know how many different sort of categories of memory. Is that what you think now maybe needs to happen with human creativity?
Well, certainly. I mean, the field of memory is so advanced compared to the field of creativity. I think there's no real comparison. And I think creativity is in so many ways much more complex. It certainly needs to happen because, like I said, it has to do with our contextual factors are really quite different. So what do we know that is common about creative cognition when I'm trying to write a poem, let's say, compared to when I'm trying to compose music, compared to when I'm standing up in front of people and performing stand-up comedy, compared to, you know, in all of these contexts, one is a musical context, one is a verbal creativity context, another one could be kinesthetic performance-based creativity. So there would be elements that are common to all forms, of course, things that we would call domain general properties of creativity. But you would expect, of course, since contextual factors are so specific, that there would be aspects of the mechanisms involved in creative idea generation that would be domain specific. So there's aspects that are specific to music, there are aspects that are specific to linguistic forms of creativity, and so on and so forth. And there is evidence to the same, of course, right? So the study of creativity certainly needs to go down that path. And I think it is. It's not that it's not happening, but it's not happening to the same extent as it is, you know, for fields like attention and memory and so on. But it's certainly necessary.
But regardless of how exactly we study and indeed define creativity, one thing we do know is the importance it plays in our lives, and indeed the lives of our ancestors too.
Hello.
This is Professor Augustine Fuentes.
My name is Augustine Fuentes. I am professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Notre Dame in the USA.
Augustine is also the author of a new book, The Creative Spark, something I spoke with him about via Skype this week. There have been a lot of books about what made or makes humans special, and they've touched on things like cooperation, violence, intelligence, cooking, you name it. Have those all missed something, do you think?
Yeah, I think what they're missing is the big picture, because everything you just mentioned, violence, cooking, cooperation, all of that is underpinned by this capacity to imagine, to think through things, to attempt new things, frequently failing, but enough time succeeding. So I think all of those stories are correct. They're just incomplete.
Early on in the book, you say that the initial condition for any creative act is collaboration. What if you can elaborate on that for us a bit?
When we think about creativity, we always think about individual geniuses, famous people who have come up with a good idea. But what we forget is that almost all good ideas, if not all good ideas, are built on the shoulders of the past, on information, on experiences, on interactions with others. So really monumental changes, really amazing creativity, always has input from more than one individual.
I'm wondering if there might be an example here that you might be able to give that really makes this link between creativity and collaboration, that shows that, you know, that some of these important steps forward, if you like, are collaborative creativity as opposed to individual creativity.
The first example is stone tools, the ability to sort of look at a rock and see inside that rock another shape that you can then use for multiple purposes. That's unique to humans. Nothing else but our lineage has ever been able to do that. And whenever we think about the creation of stone tools, we always imagine a single stone tool maker making those stone tools. But if you think about it for a moment, that individual had to learn. That individual didn't make it up themselves. And if they were the first individual ever to make a stone tool, they then taught that to others, and others picked it up. So the very central, the very earliest aspects of material creativity we see have to be done in collaboration with others. You have to go and get rocks and carry them and make them. So that's one good example. A second one is agriculture. Huge changes happen in humans' lives when we started cultivating rice or wheat, or working with dogs, or creating a kind of cow that will hang around with us and let us use them. All of that cannot be done individually. You cannot grow rice or wheat or manage cows just by yourself. You need others. You need to work through the imagination, the possibilities, the creativities to get to that point. And then if you think about everyday life, something as simple as figuring out how to get from point A to point B. We use maps. Today we use our iPhones and GPS in there. All of that is built on hundreds, if not thousands, of people working for those processes. And at the same time, hundreds of years, if not thousands of years, of history of understanding maps and movement in place. We undervalue how important collaboration is to every single thing we imagine and do.
And nowhere does this become more pertinent than with our ancestors' history of eating, something Augustine refers to in his new book as a story of innovation, collaboration, and experimentation. You talk in the book about how cooking may have played a major role in all of this, and others have talked about cooking, people like Richard Wrangham in his book Catching Fire. Just quite keen to understand a bit more about how big an impact cooking might have had on us.
I think, and Richard Wrangham is absolutely correct in this, cooking is central to humanity. There are many other things that are important, but if you step back and think about how fire has allowed us to change the chemical structure, the flavor, the context of the foods that we have access to and helped us create new foods, you can see it's opened a whole new landscape for the way in which humans interact. But I would take it even further. Cooking creates cuisine. It allows us to create sort of symbols of who we are through the foods we eat. I'm in the Cayman Islands right now, and I've been eating amazing spiced fish. That is absolutely delicious. And I could eat a piece of white fish in 20 different countries in the world, and in each place, it's going to be slightly different because of the capacity to cook, because of the capacity to spice and to change things up. So cooking is not only just functional. It didn't make us better at manipulating the world. It also gave us an incredible, open, expansive imagination to manipulate, to identify, and to create.
And does hunting come into this as well, the sort of the precursor of eating, I suppose?
Well, what's really funny is that everyone thinks hunting is just about a bunch of guys grabbing some sharp sticks and stabbing some large animal. And in fact, hunting is really part of foraging, which is the way in which we gather and collect our foods. And what's much more exciting than just stabbing a large animal is all of the variants throughout our history that have piece by piece contributed to our capacity to do what we do with food, to do what we do in the world. So hunting is really important, but hunting is also incredibly collaborative, very important. Most successful hunting involves multiple people, but it's not just about stabbing large critters. For example, early use of honey probably was really important for many human groups. The ability to get termites, just like chimpanzees do, might have been really important for humans. And the combination of fruits and leaves and meat that we hunted all came together. So hunting, while extremely important, especially the ability to get meat that it offers, is not the end-all be-all in the human story.
You talk throughout the book about how we became these super cooperators. I'm wondering if that is the natural state of affairs for humans as you see it.
Yes, of course. Cooperation is absolutely central to human success and to human existence. But I want to point out here a mistake that a lot of people make. People think when I say cooperation is the baseline, that's sort of what humans do really well, they think it always is positive cooperation. But if you think about it, something like warfare only comes about through incredible cooperation. It's not the most aggressive army that wins, it's the best cooperators. It's actually the army that cares most about each other and cooperates well that actually wins the day. So cooperation underlies both peace and war, conflict and compassion. And I think people need to understand that and not just go to this idea that cooperation means holding hands and running through the daisies.
And after this short break, we'll explore this dark side of cooperation and creativity in a little more detail.
So the big difference here, as far as the evidence we have right now, is that organized, lethal, coordinated violence that we would call warfare is fairly recent, at least given the evidence we have.
We'll also hear Anna's thoughts on Augustine's theory.
Creativity may have pushed the need for us to collaborate, but I don't think it's necessary to assume that. I don't think it's necessary not to assume that either, but I think we're talking about two different levels of function here.
We'll be right back. Before we kick off again, we wanted to recommend another of our podcasts here at The Guardian. It's called Football Weekly and sees James Richardson and the Football Weekly pod squad bring you a twice-weekly dose of puns and punditry from the Premier League and beyond throughout the 2016-17 season. Football has never sounded this good. Find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcast or search Football Weekly on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. Before the break, we heard from psychologist and neuroscientist Dr. Anna Abraham about some of the perils in trying to define, categorize, and study human creativity. Essentially, it's a lot more complicated than we often give it credit for. We also heard from Professor Augustine Fuentes, whose new book, The Creative Spark, proposes a role for creativity that allows for collaboration and social cohesion. But, as pointed out by Augustine before the break, this kind of collaboration has both good and bad sides. You spend some time in the book looking at war violence, and I was interested in how hard it is to piece together our historical behaviour when it comes to things like violence.
Yeah. Everyone wants to know, is humanity really Jekyll and Hyde? Do we have this inner demon, this beast, this sort of natural state of war that Hobbes and so many other philosophers have pointed to? And in reality, we'll probably never know. But we can get some good hints. We can come close. The biggest challenge is that none of this behavior really fossilizes in the past. We have little glimmers. We have a dented skull or something that looks like a weapon or some evidence of a massacre. But those are very, very rare. And so what I've tried to do is look at all of the archaeological data we have for deep time up until fairly recent time and ask the question, what do the actual fossil data show us? What evidence do we have? We have very, very, very little evidence for organized lethal violence, what we call warfare. We do have evidence that people were hitting each other and killing each other, not regularly, but not infrequently. So the big difference here, as far as the evidence we have right now, is that organized, lethal, coordinated violence that we would call warfare is fairly recent, at least given the evidence we have, but that the potential for incredible violence is very, very deep in human past.
I wonder, Augustine, if you've got any, and if there are any examples in the book that you'd like to share, which sort of will give us some sort of sense of that. I don't know whether there are any particular sites that had evidence for maybe small scale bludgeoning or what have you, versus, you know, when like sites came along that were showing, you know, some of this stepped up group violence. I wonder if it might be good to have a couple of thoughts on things like that.
Sure. Almost half a million years ago, we find evidence, a skull here, a fragment of a bone there, with cracks in them, both in Europe and in Africa. Oh, these are even before our species is on the scene. These are Homo erectus or Homo antecessor, different earlier forms of humans. We see crania, skulls that have been fractured. We see faces and arm bones where the flesh has been scraped from that, some kind of cannibalism. Now, these are few and far between, but they suggest that on occasion, a kind of inter-individual violence that resulted in death did occur. But they're very, very, very rare. We just don't have that many. We don't have that many fossils, so that's not too surprising. But what we do see at about, say, 10, 12, 14,000 years ago at sites like Jebel Sahaba or a recent site in Nataruk in Kenya, we see 10, 20, 30 individuals, these fossils, that were clearly damaged by blows from weapons from other humans and killed. So the difference is, in the deep past, we see these one-off examples. We see a site here, an individual there, a bone there. But as we get closer in time, especially in the last, like I said, 10 to 14,000 years, we see clusters of fossils clearly killed together by other humans.
Looking back into the deep past, and even up until reasonably recently, though, is there good enough data, and I'm talking about archaeological data here, to make a call on this either way? I mean, I can see once things like warfare has been documented, then you can have a fairly good sort of data set, if you like, a fairly good record of what's happened. But as soon as you end up going into the archaeological record, you are getting very, very selective. We're talking about very few data points, right?
Yes, right, absolutely. So, I mean, the best way to say this is war exists now, only humans do it, what we call warfare. Other organisms have, like chimps and others, have some of these like lethal raids and violence, but nothing has symbolic sort of philosophical rationales for mass killing. We do that quite well. And we know that shows up in written records in the last 4 or 5,000 years. We have some good archaeological evidence for things like this 5 to 10,000 years ago, but you're absolutely right. The further we go back in time, the less evidence there is for this or against it. Now, I fall more on the against it side earlier because there's just zero evidence pre about 14,000 years ago. I could be wrong, but at this point, the data we have suggests that while violence occurred, large-scale, lethal, coordinated warfare did not.
An interesting hypothesis then, but with so little evidence, there is not much substance to weave a solid theory around. But regardless of whether or not the theory is right, what has violence got to do with creativity?
So let's differentiate the kinds of violence. You could ask, what does violence have to do with creativity? We can differentiate. One-on-one violence happens for many, many reasons. You know, you get really angry with someone, you're fighting over some food, you're fighting over a man or a woman, or you're fighting over a sense of feeling slighted. That happens in a variety of ways. Where creativity really comes to the fore is when you organize a group of individuals to commit violence to another group. How does creativity work? Well, you said collaboration is important, so you need to collaborate. You need to be able to cooperate together to do that. But to really get human beings to work together, to go risk their life, to attack other human beings, you have to create a sense of mission and purpose, and you also have to creatively dehumanize the others. You have to create a space where people are capable of doing horrible things to others, and to do that, you have to creatively dehumanize them, because we have good data that suggests it's really hard for humans to kill other humans on a regular basis. You look at what happens to all soldiers, or a large percentage of soldiers who experience this in warfare. There's a lot of psychological trauma and other traumas. So to make good soldiers, to do large-scale cruelty and lethal aggression well, we have to create scenarios where we dehumanize others and create powerful symbols that unite us to want to go out, risk our lives, and hurt others. There's a lot of creativity involved there.
You've made me realize how positively I always view the word creativity. I hadn't quite appreciated the dark side of the word.
Yeah. Well, but I think that's really important to think, and that's why I'm arguing. People say, oh, you're saying everyone's cooperating, everyone's all happy. I'm like, step back. I'm really interested in the larger scale processes. Understanding creativity and cooperation is what makes us humans really distinctive, really exceptional, but it has very, very dark possibilities as well as wonderful, engaging, positive possibilities. We can't sell ourselves short on either end. We are neither the nicest nor the nastiest, neither the cruelest nor the best species, but we have the capacity to be all those things.
Regardless of whether creativity leads us down one path or another, the fact that it's so fundamental to our species makes it very hard to unpick.
For me, creativity is a fundamental human capacity.
Anna Abraham again.
It's understanding that that's the way we think. As a species, we feel this need to express and find novel ways to do it. And whether it's on, you know, through cave paintings or through, you know, formulating our little tweets now or wanting particular types of foam on our lattes, whatever, you know, foam designs on our lattes, it doesn't matter. Like, there's this need to really just do something that I can do, something unique. And that is a fundamental drive. And I think creativity may have pushed the need for us to collaborate, but I don't think it's necessary to assume that. I don't think it's necessary not to assume that either. But I think we're talking about two different levels of function here. People want to express themselves because they want to sort of stand out in their collective, or want to be known, or want to be seen, or want to be seen as the individual. But an individual only makes sense in a collective context.
Something Augustine thinks can now be harnessed when looking to the future of our species.
I think something that's really important when we think about what it means to be human and what it means for the future of humanity, we need to look to our past and ask ourselves, what are the patterns? What data do we have to explain those patterns? We know that cooperation is central in the human experience, and that's made us who we are. We also know that the capacity to create, to imagine possibilities and make them reality, is a critical part of what's gotten us this far. But the outcome of that creativity and that cooperation can be very, very bad. It can allow us to manipulate the world and manipulate other humans in ways that no other organisms can. And at the same time, it can allow us to figure ways out of that. And so I take that as an optimistic statement. Even though we can do horrible things to each other in the world, we can do even better things to get us out of the things that we created.
Special thanks this week to Anna Abraham and Augustine Fuentes. We'll include a link to Augustine's book, The Creative Spark, as well as a paper by Anna on the promises and perils of the neuroscience of creativity in the episode's description on the Guardian website. I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.